Today is November the 15th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and I'm in the studio of the Progressive Radio Network, and my colleague Joe King is able to join me this evening. Podcasts of this program is available on PRN.FM, and our website is PCRadioshow.org. The regular program of the Personal Computer Show on WBAI has been preempted this evening, and WBI is in emergency fundraising mode and has preempted all regular programming from 9 a.m. to midnight this Tuesday and Wednesday. So let's do the thing that we have to do, Joe, and that to follow up on what we did last week when we talked about Microsoft, the ending their free upgrade on Windows 10. We said that there is a you can download Windows 10 that you can still use even after the end of the year. And I said that I will post the URL onto our website because it's a big, long URL.
But the one thing you didn't say is where on our website?
Well, I think I made an assumption, right? Well, actually, let me do it two ways, okay? I'll just repeat it. If anyone happens to be recording the show or downloads a podcast, they can listen to it a number of times. But if you were to key in three words, the three words are in a search.
Wait, where are they keying it?
Let's say if you're using let's say you're running a Google search, okay? Because this way I could say in a Google search, if you key in these three words, here's what you would find. And what you want to do is, actually it's more than three words, okay? Key in the word media, M-E-D-I-A, space, creation, media, space, creation, space, Windows, space 10 space download. So it's you do a search on media creation Windows 10 download, and you will come back with a results. Do not go to the first result because that is not a Microsoft site. It's a one of those sites where you're going to get a lot of crapware with it. You go to the second one, which says Microsoft.com. That is a legitimate Microsoft site. And for those who want to care to know, it's /en-us/software-download/Windows 10.
Which none of you wrote, so I'm going to tell you what to do. Go to our website, which is pcradioshow.org. Go to the archive for last week's show or the archive for tonight's show. For last week's show, the URL will be actually written out in the description, so you can just get that from there. And that, incidentally, every time Hank says we're going to post something to the website, that's what he means you should do. Go to our website, go to the night that you're listening to the podcast, and in the description will be the information he's giving you.
And let me just repeat what I did say last week, because it is important. In that Microsoft said that after the end of this year, they will no longer make Windows 10 available as a free upgrade to Windows 7, 8, or 8.1. Now, what they'll probably do is they'll either remove the Windows 10 ISO or the binary distribution from their website, or they'll modify it so that if you try to do an upgrade, it will ask you for a valid serial number that you purchased for Windows 10. Now, if I have tested, and it has not been a problem at all, that with the existing version of what you can download, the Windows 10 ISO file, you can do an upgrade free on 7, 8, and 8.1. And although I've done it in both modes, I would recommend that you do the upgrade where you are not connected to the internet, because one of the things I ask for is, do you want to download the updates? You don't want to inadvertently download the updates that prevent you from upgrading. So my recommendation is do the upgrade first, and then because you become Windows 10, you will then be able to do the upgrade. Now, this is very important because for those who bought Windows 7, and let's say in October of 2015, and then the very next month they had released Windows 10. Well, okay, you got your Windows 10. But if you had to do a factory reset, guess what? You end up with Windows 7 again, and you say, wait a minute, I'm entitled to Windows 10. How do you get it back? So what you have to do is make sure you download that distribution binary file. of Windows 10 and do it now. And, oh, by the way, do not wait until the last minute to do it, because I'm sure everyone's going to, you know, be – it's going to go very slow if you try that, all right? If there's any problem, just send us a piece of email if you have any other questions on it to hank@pcradioshow.org.
Hank, there's one thing I'd like to clarify. Not clarify. I'd like to reemphasize something you just said. Everybody who has Windows 7, 8, or 8.1 should download the Windows 10 upgrade now. You don't need it now. You don't even want it now. But download it, put it on a disk, put it in your strong box, put it wherever you keep safe things. Because maybe next year, for some reason that you're not even thinking about, a piece of software that you might want to run, download it and keep it safe.
And the other thing is that if you have already upgraded, but you haven't downloaded a copy of the Windows 10 binary, you should do it, because if you ever happen to have to do a factory reset, you don't have it if you didn't download it. So just to do it, okay? That's all part of the, what I call it, have you backed up yet? That's part of one of the backup things you have to do.
It's also part of what I call Murphy's Law.
If you don't do it, you wish you had done it, right?
There's two kinds of people in this world, those who back up and those who wished they had backed up. In this case, it's those who have downloaded Windows 10 and those who wished they had downloaded Windows 10.
Now, there's a company by the name of Enigma, and they have two pieces of software, and I've tested it, okay, and I'm not impressed with it. It's called Spy Hunter, and the other one, a program, is a Reg Hunter, and it's supposed to say they will look for spyware, and if they detect any spyware, they let you know.
It's a free program.
Both are very free programs, but what I didn't like about it was, okay, you told me. And they said, oh, by the way, if you want to clean up, you got to give us your credit card. You know what? To me, that's not a free program, okay? Why don't you just tell me it's a trial? You should tell me ahead of time. If you don't tell me ahead of time that there's a catch to it, you know what? I'd stop using it. Now, what I do is I uninstall it, but guess what? When you use the regular method of uninstalling it, it doesn't uninstall. So that really is, to me, more malware than anything else. Now, there is a malware program called Malware Bytes, which I think many of you may be familiar with. And they have flagged this as being a potential problem, and they would quarantine it. And guess what? Enigma took them to court saying, you can't do that to us.
Well, obviously, Enigma's lawyer had not bothered having a research done on the subject, because the same thing had happened to Kaspersky a while back. Somebody had sued Kaspersky for the same reason, and Kaspersky won. And again, Enigma lost this one against Malwarebytes for the same reason. It is well within reasonable commercial behavior for a malware program, an anti-malware program, to hang the cord of malware around a program that comes in like this and can't be erased. Incidentally, Hank, how do you erase it?
I use IOBIT. It's a program. It's very good. And it will do not only does it do an erase or remove, but it also eliminates, when you uninstall a program, it leaves mouse trails of the folder and parameters and so on. It will actually clean up all the mouse trails.
How much did that cost you?
It's free.
How do you get it?
I downloaded it.
So if you want the one that Hank uses, do a Google search for IOBytes, IOBYTES.
Mm-hmm. And they actually have a companion program, which I use, and which it would do a deep search on junk files and everything else, and it will clean it up for you instead of saying, this is look what I found. If you want to clean up, I want your credit card. They don't do that, right? And you probably ask, well, what is their business model? Well, they do other things too. And if you like it, you know what? It's I can't quite call it beggarware because there's no ads. You know, normally, you know, you get these freeware programs and you get these pop-up ads and so on. These guys are pretty good, okay? And they do have an option where – You can use some of the other services, like optimizing your drive in terms of cleaning up your drives and so on. It's actually pretty good. I like the product. I use it. And
again, the name of it?
The other companion program right now is escaping me right now. But the IO Byte, if you download that, that does the program removal, and that it points you to the other things it can do. Okay. By the way, Joe, there's another thing that you should be aware of, and that the new version, I call it new version, of Windows 10, I think it's called the build number 1709, which is 17, which is this year, and or they just released this in late October, or they call it 1709, is that that version has what they call an anti-ransomware feature in it. And what it is that they have what is called a control folder access. And there are things about it where if ransomware has to make changes to that control folder access, and there are attributes in there, and most people don't know what they mean by attributes. In other words, you could say read-only, write-only, or hide it, and, you know, all the different ways you can do with a folder and a subdirectory. And they actually have a name for it, but I'm not going to give you that technical name. And it can prevent it, but I said to Joe, it's not 100% because you would get a flag, a warning, and what would you do? Well, Joe said what he would do, and I said, I wouldn't do that. Because what Joe said was, well, you get a flag, okay, I don't want it, and then you keep running. No, I don't do that. If I've got a flag warning, I stop, I look at what is causing that flag warning, and clean up anything that I have to clean up.
Actually, there was something very similar in Windows a while back where you had to have a certain level of efficiency. Hank, would put himself in as an admin, and I would put myself in as just a general user. And if Hank wanted to make a change, if I wanted to make a change in the folder, I was told I had to get admin permission. If Hank wanted to make a change in the folder, he was asked whether he's an admin. He would say yes, and they would say, put in a password then, and several other things. And eventually he got to the point where he said, phooey. He disabled that whole checking so that he wasn't questioned a second and a third time.
Well, with ransomware, you have to understand that the program and the mechanics, at least that could be implemented, but one of the things that they cannot do, and that's called social engineering, to fake you out and saying, hey, this is an important message from Microsoft, when it's not. We need permission to be able to give you the ability to claim your $100 or, you know, whatever gimmicks they use. And unfortunately, it's that social engineering that there's almost no way of. How do you prevent it?
Well, one thing you do is, if it sounds too good to be true, you know that it's not true. That's one. Second thing is, you can always check the origin of the message or the email. I got an email yesterday that told me that they had tried to deposit $1,750 to my account, and it didn't work. Would I please check the account number? I didn't check, and it looked like it came from a legitimate company that I had done business with. I don't know why they would have sent me money, but what I did do is I checked the header on the email, and I found that the email had not really come from the company that it said it was coming from. It had spoofed it. You can always do that. You can check the header of the email. You can check the URL of the site they want you to click onto. Don't take somebody's word for something that sounds too good to be true.
Well, I had one that was pretty neat. The way they did it is that apparently, with all these cookies, they could determine what websites you go to and what you're interested in, almost to the extent of did you buy anything from there, okay, because there's certain executions you got to do. And I got a message from FedEx saying that your package is ready and we were unable to deliver it. Can you just print out, you know, just hit the word print and use that slip and go to the FedEx site to pick it up. Well, what they don't realize is that in New York City, there's more than one FedEx site. And if you didn't tell me which one, It's a phony.
Well, actually, if you had checked the header of the email, you also would have said it was a phony. But the thing that I found interesting, Hank, I got a similar one. If you hit the print button, you're not hitting a print button.
Right. And I'll tell you something else, okay? You say, look at the header, all right? You know what the header said? www.fedex.abc.com. And you think that's FedEx. It should be the other way around. Not, in other words, it should be FedEx.com, not starting with FedEx, dot something else.
Exactly. They'll be very clever. One thing I did find in every one of those spoofed emails that I've gotten over the years is at least one misspelling.
Hey, Joe, you know, Las Vegas is a fascinating city. I don't know if you've ever been there.
Oh, yes.
I've been there many, many times.
Who was the comedian who used to refer to it as Lost Wages?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not that old, okay? What it is that Las Vegas, they debuted a little truck that looks like an oversized Herbie car, you know, the Volkswagen called Herbie. And they call it a van, all right, or a truck. And it's a driverless shuttle that is free to get people from one point to the other. And, Joe, tell them what happened on the very first day of operation or first hour of operation.
Well, when Hank says it was a driverless shuttle, we've all read about the autonomous car, the autonomous van, which doesn't need any human interaction. It's run by a computer. And Hank wants me to say something, but I'm not going to say that. What happened to it the first time it went out is somebody else bumped into it.
He got into an accident in the very first hour.
But it was somebody else who bumped into it.
Which you, the way the headline read was that you got, the implication was it didn't work, but the reality was it did work, except that the other guy was at fault. And he really was at fault because he backed up right into it.
The other guy was backing up out of a driveway. The autonomous van was minding its own business, and it got hit. Now, that's one of the reasons that I have deep questions about it. Yes, if the other car that hit it, the truck that backed up into it, had been autonomous, it would not have happened. But that means that everybody on the highway, everybody on the road, has to have an autonomous vehicle for the first autonomous vehicle to be safe. That's never going to happen.
Let me ask you this. If you were to go to Las Vegas next week, would you be inclined to get into that driverless truck?
No, I can do it right here in the city. I can take the Times Square shuttle subway.
Well, that's different because it's on a track and there's no one else on the track, okay? There's a little, same thing with train to the plane, okay? Or it's called the train to the plane, right? Mm-hmm. Same thing. It's on a monorail, but there's no interfering traffic or vehicle with it.
That's why I'd be willing to try that.
Now, Joe, back in the 50s, you remember that when you went to, the Chrysler building or the Woolworth building, you always have an operator operate the elevator, and he'll try to, get right to that floor without, jiggling the elevator. What was your first reaction like when you got into the elevator? Was it no operator? What was your immediate reaction?
I don't remember. It was so long ago. I don't remember. I was probably...
It was like 1955. What do you mean so long ago?
No, I was in automatic elevators in the 40s. But, Hank, it's a different thing. Here you're out on the street. It's like the government is now using drone autonomous planes called drones.
Yeah, but you know how they're using it, though. Can I tell you how?
How are they using it?
Well, because we have a lot of B-29s mothballed and... they are – now, that's huge. The B-29 is –
they're not doing B-29s.
No. Yes, they are. You know what? They send them on bombing missions, and if they get shot down, who cares? That's the point.
No, actually, they're not using B-29s. They're using Predators, and I forget the name of the other one. There's two main drones that they're using. And they're perfectly safe to use because there's nobody on them, and there's nobody in the sky. On the other hand, now that – drones are freely available. I would say at Radio Shack, but there is no Radio Shack anymore. I guess they're where Best Buy or Fry's or places like that. But commercial pilots are now getting worried because these stupid little hand-sized or arm-sized drones are flying in the commercial airspace. They're not supposed to. And they'll really write some very significant laws as soon as enough people are killed.
Now, wait a minute. You know, one of the things I have not figured out yet is how does Amazon plan to make drone deliveries and not have any accidents with all that clutter in the sky?
Who said they don't plan on having accidents?
You mean they don't care?
Yeah. Why should they care? Kill people? Hey, listen, if they kill you or your wife, they'll just get another customer.
You know, a number of years ago, I think about maybe in the early 90s that you referenced, Joe, that's about 25 years ago, when wireless first came into being, it was the orientation of the antenna. And I know that, you know, do you swing it this way or swing it that way? And I think at one time you said to me, well, get a piece of aluminum and you know, fool around with a piece of aluminum to get a stronger signal.
And indeed, no, I didn't tell you a piece of aluminum. I told you to get a Pringles can.
They had Pringles then?
Yeah. And a lot of people got the Pringles can and fooled with it. It didn't do too good on the 2400 cycle. 2.4 cycle, but it did pretty good on the 5.2. And a lot of people were using it. And things comparable to it. There were articles. You can still find the articles on Wikipedia if you want to know how to do a Pringles can. One of the articles on Wikipedia pointed out to me that what was wrong with the Pringles can and how to do it with a can of they gave the brand name of dried milk, which was a bigger size can or a different size can. And it turns out that it was very critical what the diameter of the can was in ratio to the length of the can.
And the shape. And the form of it.
We're talking now about cans.
Okay.
Then somebody came up. This was back in the first time I heard about it was 2006, but there were a lot going on in 2008. Then the other day, Hank called me and said, did you hear about this new thing with aluminum foil? And what he said to me was some young genius in some school someplace had discovered that instead of the Pringles can, you could make it much more accurate if you had a 3D printer and you made a special shape out of the aluminum foil.
Well, what happened was that it was announced that Dartmouth College and Columbia University, probably the engineering departments in both of those two schools, they got together. And what they did was they wrote a program that actually designed what the form should be to optimize, because based on location and the unit itself and so on, to get the strongest wireless signal. And then, obviously, the form is not something that is, is like a Pringle can, okay? And then what they did was they wrote a program so that it can operate on a 3D printer to print out the actual, antenna itself. And what they're saying is that you can increase the distance of your wireless transmission by quite a bit by doing that. And I said to Joe, well, you know what? If you're interested in that, you don't need a 3D printer. So you fold it by hand, because in one case it looks like something you bend in three, you know, I think it looks like a U-shaped thing. Another looks like a parabola. So maybe the program itself would tell you how best to get a better signal. And if you know someone with a 3D printer, maybe they can generate the proper antenna for you.
Well, both of these things are called waveguide aerials or waveguide antennas. And as usual, the hackers who built them have come up with a better name. They call them cantennas because they started off by doing it with a Pringles can or a dried milk can. As I said, if you want more of this, go into Google or go into the Web Archives. Do you know about the Web Archives, Hank? It's web.archive.org. And this organization tries to cite everything that ever appeared on the web, on the World Wide Web. It's an amazing archive. And there's a place called on the Web Archives, which you can also find in other places. It's called PCFAQs. and how to build a Cantenna aerial, and they'll give you much more information than you ever wanted to read.
Well, Joe, if I don't have the time, maybe I'll just use a regular Pringle can. Hey, wait a minute. We're not here to advertise Pringle, are we?
I don't like Pringles, Hank. They're imitation potato chips.
No, actually, it's chemical.
Is it?
You know, everything like processed cheese and all that stuff. Where's the food in it? It's cockamamie chemicals.
You've got a choice. Do you want cockamamie chemicals or do you want food? You want food? Go out to the farmer.
There's a third choice. You know what the third choice is? I just want to fill my stomach.
Well,
you know, it's like I love ice cream. Okay, but have you ever looked at the ingredients?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, should I tell you what the ingredients in the ice cream I eat are?
Well, I got to tell you something. I love vanilla ice cream, but there's very few brands that actually have real vanilla ice cream.
I'll give you a brand that consists of milk or cream, I should say.
Oh, and they don't have that. They have fructose, they call it.
No, they have cream, they have sugar, and they have vanilla bean. And it's sold in the supermarket. It's called Breyers.
Hey, Joe, let me go through one other item that was announced. T-Mobile, we talk about their highest speed network. And I'm not surprised, but you were, okay? Because you kept saying only one phone qualifies for that high speed network, and that was the LG V30. No, it turns out to be 10 units.
10 out of 4,000.
Well, let me just say that.
You know what's not included in your list?
Yeah. Let me tell you. It includes the Galaxy. It includes the...
Wait a minute. A Galaxy...
S8. The Galaxy Note 8. The LG V30. The HTC U11. And so on. But the
not
two,
and so on. There's about three more.
Three more. But it does not include the iPhone 8 and the Apple iPhone 10. And you say to yourself, why do I want to buy a new item for $1,000 that... can't take advantage of it.
It doesn't include the Pixel. It doesn't include any of the Pixels, any of the Nexums. Hank, it's a statement that was built by a marketing department, not an engineering department.
Well, the reason why a lot of the phones are not ready for it is because everyone figured it'll be the end of 2018 when the lines will be available. Because when the Spectrum was awarded to T-Mobile. What most people didn't know was that they were working behind the scenes with Qualcomm to enable them to do it in 6 months with hardware. And by the way, the existing 8 and 10 iPhones cannot be upgraded because hardware is required.
Now, the thing that T-Mobile has not really promoted to anybody is that Verizon has the same facilities only in more cities, but they're not talking about it yet because there's no phones to use it.
Well, the other thing that I do want to bring out is that they claim it's a gigabyte LTE.
Well,
go ahead. I know what you're going to say.
They claim it's a gigabyte LTE. I claim it's a fashoodles LTE.
Wait a minute. First of all, it's not 1 gigabyte. It's less. You know what this is like buying? It's like buying a 10 gigabyte hard drive. There's no real 10 gigabyte. It's less than that because they treat the word gig as being 1,000 and not 1024, and that adds up.
That would be acceptable. But here, their 1 gigabyte is 600 megs in some cases.
Well, it depends on the location.
It's 800 megs in some cases. As a matter of fact, the biggest I've seen so far is about 850 megs. Not gigs, not gigabits, not gigabytes. That's giga nonsense.
We should ask people who... like to comment on that, just send it to comments to either Hank or Joe at pcradioshow.org. And let's get to the second half of the show. For the second half hour, we have the following segments. I will be doing a segment on the disappearing digital compact cameras, and this will be followed by Dr. Alfred Poor with wearable and health technology, in which he covers sensors in a mesh network for worker safety at construction sites, and a sensor vest to diagnose pneumonia in small children, and he'll follow this up with a smartphone app and device to test children's vision at home. I will then follow up with where are the STEM jobs, and I've asked Marty Winston to talk about some hacker gifts since Christmas and Black Friday's coming up. The disappearing compact digital camera. Things aren't looking good for the standalone point-and-shoot camera. As smartphone cameras continue to improve, compact camera sales continue to nosedive. In a nutshell, photography is more popular than ever. Witness the rise of Instagrams or Snapchat. 98.4% of the consumer cameras sold last year were built into smartphones. Less than 1% were in compacts, less than 0.5% in digital single-lens reflex cameras, and less than 0.2% in mirrorless cameras. An easy prediction is that smartphones will continue to get better and compact camera sales will, well, get to near zero. The obvious reason for the decline? The ubiquitous smartphone, which is a combination of a mobile phone, personal computer, data storage unit, and a camera. Small enough to fit in a pocket. Nearly 60% of U.S. homes now have one, compared with 70% of homes that own one or more cameras. It is easier to take your smartphone out of your pocket if you want to take a picture of someone or something, and you can send the picture to friends quickly on social media. Smartphones represent a completely different market of digital communication devices, which just happens to include a digital imaging capability. The evidence of this stems from the fundamental motivation that consumers have when they make a purchase. When you or I buy a camera, we do so because the primary intent is taking pictures. It's hard to believe that anyone would buy a smartphone with its primary intent was to take pictures. The competition from smartphones has almost killed the cheapest camera, but at the same time, so many people are taking photos as never before in human history. So it is no surprise that Nikon announced that they will shut down their camera factory in China. Nikon employs some 2,500 workers at a factory that produce compact digital cameras and digital single-lens reflex lens. The closure, says Nikon, is due to the rise of the smartphones and the rapidly shrinking compact camera market. Nikon's announcement of the closure lays the blame for this cut squarely on the shoulders of the smartphone revolution. Of course, the end of Nikon doesn't mean the end of Nikon cameras in China. Nikon controls 30% of the digital camera market there, and Nikon says it will continue proactively develop business and services in China. This move is simply in keeping with the harsh reality that the smartphone has killed the entry-level compact. Nikon also announced that in Brazil, they will stop selling the cameras, lens, and photographic accessories in the Brazilian market as of December 31, 2017. The company's other business segments, including customer service and technical assistance, will continue to operate normally. Products under warranty, including those marketed by Nikon, will continue to honor the warranty periods. For out-of-warranty products, however, technical assistance will be provided on a cash approved by the owners.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Let's face it, a construction site can be a dangerous place to be. You've got lots of people working in lots of different areas. Many times they're working with power equipment and other dangerous tools. They're working on unfinished buildings, often many stories up in the sky. They may be working in groups. They may be working by themselves. They may be working out of sight of other people. And it's very possible that supervisors can't keep an eye on everybody all the time. And so managing the risks and preventing injuries and accidents and dealing with those injuries and accidents when they occur, those are all big problems for construction site job managers. Well, there's a company called Triax Technologies trying to address some of these problems. They've created a device that they call the Spotter, S-P-O-T-R. What this is a device that clips onto the belt of the worker and they wear it around the job site. One of the things it can do is it can automatically detect when the wearer falls and can automatically send out an alert if the worker doesn't trigger it themselves. It also has a panic button that you can press to summon help. Now, one of the cool things about it is that it also determines the worker's location on the job site. The way that works isn't by using GPS or something like that. What they do is they set up their own proprietary mesh network of transmitters and receivers around the job site. Using these radio waves, they can pinpoint the location of every worker all the time. One of the important features of this is that it only works when you're on the job site. Now, if it were GPS, it could track you when you're away from the job site. But for privacy reasons, this system doesn't track you once you leave the job site. But it does automatically register you when you come on the job site, so managers know when you arrive, when you leave, and just how many people there are on site. So if there's an emergency, say there was a gas leak and you need everybody to evacuate, you would know exactly how many people are at risk, and you could keep track of whether or not everybody's been evacuated or not. So it's a pretty neat example of how wearable technology can help make workers safer and save money, save time, save productivity, and save even lives. In underdeveloped regions, diseases and conditions that are annoyances or just a problem in first world countries, they can be life-threatening, especially for children. And one of the problems is there's a lack of trained experts who can properly diagnose the different kinds of diseases and conditions that children can get. One of the highest ranking causes of death for children is pneumonia, of all things, which is a condition that is not generally life-threatening in the developed parts of the world. So the problem is, how do you improve the diagnosis of pneumonia and whether or not it gets treated properly? How do you distinguish it from malaria or asthma or tuberculosis or other lung diseases? Also, within pneumonia, the disease could be caused by a virus or it could be caused by bacteria. If you don't choose the correct treatment, it won't be effective. So getting the correct diagnosis is very important. A team working in Uganda has developed a smart vest called the Mama Ope. And this is a vest that has sensors built in, and it's designed to let relatively unskilled health workers better diagnose lung disease, and especially pneumonia, for children from 0 to 5. Basically, what happens is the sensors in the vest will read the child's vital signs and can then continuously monitor and save the patient data. This can then be used to create a much more accurate diagnosis of the disease that the child has so that they get the proper treatment as quickly and effectively as possible. With luck, this smart jacket for children in Uganda and other parts of Africa could help save many lives. If you have school-age children, you may have noticed sometimes that your child may complain of headaches or may start doing poorly in school and complain that they can't tell what's going on, or you know, they just are having difficulty in the classroom. One of the main causes of this is vision problems. A young child doesn't know whether or not they're having problems seeing. For them, the world is the way it is, and they just accept that, and so it's hard for them to know. Certainly, you can go to an ophthalmologist or other healthcare professional and get your child screened for vision problems, but these can develop over time, they can get worse, and sometimes it's not convenient or expensive to go get your child's eyes checked frequently. A company called IQ has created a smartphone app that allows you to test the visual acuity of a child or anyone in your own home. It works with children as young as 6, and it is much easier to use than, say, a standard eye chart, which normally requires like a 20-foot testing range. It can be administered by somebody with no extensive training. It essentially works like a game. The child responds to these puzzles and tests, and very quickly it can determine the level of visual acuity that the child has. The device is available now for pre-order on Kickstarter. Basically, you purchase the device and then you pay a very small annual subscription to maintain the software and keep it up to date. So with this, families should be able to help their children keep good vision and make sure they can see what's going on in the front of the classroom, read well, and help them succeed better in their schools.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. We are the STEM jobs. The national priority in education can be summed up in 4-letter acronym, STEM. STEM, which is spelled out STEM, stands for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. The STEM campaign has been championed by policymakers, embraced in schools everywhere, and by technology organizations. By now, the term, first popularized and promoted by the National Science Foundation, is used as a discipline identifier. In the use of STEM, it's usually meant as a compliment. Much of the public enthusiasm for STEM education is based on the assumption that these fields are rich in job opportunity. In reality, some are, but some aren't. STEM is an expansive category spanning many disciplines and occupations, from software engineers and data science to geologists, astronomers, and physicists. What recent studies have been made increasingly apparent is that the greatest number of high-paying STEM jobs are in that T area, specifically technology or computing. Earlier this year, a job listing website, Glassdoor, ranked the median base salary of workers in their first 5 years of employment by undergraduate majors. Computer science topped the list with $70,000, followed by electrical engineering, $68,000, biochemistry, $46,000, and biotechnology, $48,000, were among the lowest paid majors in the study, which also confirmed that women are generally underrepresented in the STEM majors. At LinkedIn, researchers identified the skills most in demand. The top 10 last year were all in computer skills, including expertise in cloud computing, data mining, and statistical analysis, and writing smartphone applications. In a Bureau of Labor Statistics employment forecast in STEM categories, it is projected that 73% of STEM job growth will be in the computer occupation area, but only 3% will be in physical sciences and 3% in life sciences. Executives and lobbyists for technology companies do a disservice when they raise the alarm that America is facing a worrying shortfall of STEM workers based on shortages in a relatively handful of fast-growing fields like data analytics, artificial intelligence, cloud computing, and computer security. When it gets generalized to all STEM, it's misleading. We're misleading a lot of young people. Unemployment rates for STEM majors may be low, but not all of those with undergraduate degrees end up in their field of study. Only 13% in life sciences and 17% in physical sciences, according to a National Science Foundation survey, and computer science is the only STEM field where more than half the graduates are employed in their field.
I think I've mentioned that in designing and building our 40-year house project, that's 40yearhouse.com, we end up modifying a lot of electronics that are there or improvising pieces that are missing from the electronics that are out there, doing what we need to do to make things just simply run smoothly together and do what we want them to do. Now, you know, do they need batteries? Let's hope not. We're forbidding batteries. Do they need RF? Let's hope not. There are some places, yeah, you do. Most places, no. Wiring it is better. So we got back to something that we'd been doing in the 1970s, working directly with electronics parts and circuit boards and so on, cobbling things together, modifying things. And in so doing, you know, we had to go and do a lot of homework online. We had to revamp our tool sets and techniques and so on. But we found out that the community of people who are popularly called makers, and we're not talking about 3D printing, we're talking about people who are electronic experimenters today, is growing. It's huge. And Hank asked me to find a couple of products that almost anybody could use to get started getting into that level of familiarity of building and working with and having fun with electronics. So one of the people I turned to is a fellow named Simon Monk, a very prolific author. He's got 20-some books out there, books like Hacking Electronics, Electronics Cookbook, and Practical Electronics for Inventors. He also has some programming books and some Arduino and Raspberry Pi stuff out there, but, you know, he's a guy in a different era, and if we were on the same continent, we might be drinking buddies. He's also the guy behind Monk Makes, where he develops projects and kits. Now, we singled out, working with him, we singled out a couple of his Monk Makes kits that might interest you, or might interest you as a gift for somebody you know who might be interested in electronics and being a maker and experimenting and all that stuff. So one of them is the Clever Card Kit that lets you fool around with RFID smart cards. It works with a Raspberry Pi, which is in any case something you'll learn to fear, hate, and love, not necessarily in that order. I could tell you what's in the Clever Card Kit, but even better, Simon Monk can tell you himself.
Monk Makes offers the Clever Card Kit. The Clever Card Kit is an educational kit for the Raspberry Pi based on a smart card reader. The kit includes an RFID smart card reader writer, jumper leads to connect your reader to your Raspberry Pi, a Raspberry Leaf GPIO template, 6 credit card sized RFID cards and a key fob, an RGB LED and a push button. The included 25-page booklet covers connecting the reader and downloading the software. It then goes on to describe 6 projects that you can make with the kit. Projects include using a card as virtual money with Monopoly and a launcher that will open your browser on a web page programmed onto the card.
Okay, maybe working with RFID cards is a little too specific or a little too narrow for you or the person you're buying this for. So let's go back to that Hacking Electronics books that he wrote. He has a companion kit that goes with it, the Hacking Mega Kit. And again, Simon?
Monk Makes offers the Hacking Electronics Mega Kit. This kit was designed while I was writing the second edition of my best-selling introductory electronics book, Hacking Electronics. It goes hand in hand with the book, allowing you to make many of the projects and also providing you with a good foundation kit of parts to get you started on your electronics adventure. There are too many parts to list, but as well as a multimeter, breadboard, jumper wires and protoboard, there are over 95 electronic components as well as motors, a battery box and switches.
It is a very real, very hands-on introduction to many of the basic electronic components, plus a multimeter to help you understand what they do, and plenty of stuff to start quickly and simply putting together some basic working gizmos on the solderless breadboard. Now, if you add the Hacking Electronics book to that kit for a more guided and educational tour, well, there's a second gift. And later, if you want, you can also add an Arduino or a Raspberry Pi. The book has projects for those two little prototyping computers, controllers in one case, computer in the other, in the book as well. Now, that's the hardware. Now, if you're not sure how advanced somebody's interests may be, but you're pretty sure they're interested in electronics hardware, think about finding some interesting tools that might upgrade what they've been working with. Electronic experimenters tend to need tools that are smaller than usual. Cuticle-scale wire cutters, pliers just a little bigger than tweezers, maybe even small right-angle ratchet screwdrivers. Ashtray-sized magnetic parts trays can be very helpful, and clamp-on LED task lamps can't have enough light. Well, you can, but you're unlikely to. A decent adjustable height stool is also welcome at any workbench, and you'll know it the minute you've spent too long there and your back hurts. Stools at the right height, avoid that. Or, you know, another option for those of you looking to encourage electronics interests in the person for whom you're buying gifts, yourself, somebody else, friends, family, neighbor, school, church, you can always choose a store that sells hobby electronics, real or online, and give a gift card. It's another way to go, just as valid, and they get to decide for themselves what interests them. I do get a lot of questions about Arduino versus Raspberry Pi. Which one should you learn to work with if you're learning to do all of this stuff? There are differences, but And by the way, there are differences within those families. There are lots of models of Arduino. There are lots of models of Raspberry Pi. We know the ones you're going to be looking at most. So let's just get down to the families and deal with those. The family of Arduinos is more of a controller than a computer. It takes very, very simple instructions, but there's only so much it can do with the sensors that are there and with the effectors, the actuators you can connect to it. if that's enough for you, fine, but it has, in maker's term, a low ceiling. Raspberry Pi is an actual computer. It's a 64-bit computer, a four-core computer, very, very capable, little decacard-sized thing. The best Raspberry Pi costs as much as, or as little as, or pretty much close to the same cost as one of the better Arduino models. So it's not a price consideration. The consideration is, do you want to limit yourself or not? Although there is a little more programming to do with the Raspberry Pi, learning that is part of what you want to accomplish too. So get back to the books, take a look at what might interest people, take a look at the kits that are out there for every age and starting point. Get back to the stores where you're not quite sure what to buy and find a store that has what seems to be a good variety. Give a gift card to that store and that might do it. And then as you get experimenting, take Hank's advice. Back up the power, back up the data, back up the documentation. Just don't make Santa rush back up the chimney. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements for computer club meetings in the Northeast Tri-State area. Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, November the 28th, 7 p.m. at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on augmented reality with Microsoft HoloLens. Meeting is on Thursday, November the 30th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have a presentation on web browser shootouts Friday, December the 1st. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has a presentation on Minecraft, Tuesday, December the 5th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on new tech toys just in time for Christmas, Tuesday, December the 5th. Meeting time is 1:30 p.m. Community Room, 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. Westchester PC Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, December the 7th, 7 p.m. Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor in White Plains, New York. Long Island Mac Users Group will be meeting Friday, December the 8th, 7 p.m. at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, Auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. New York Amateur Computer Club will have a meeting on Toolkit of Tips and Tricks, Thursday, December the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, Room 401 in Manhattan, New York. All these meetings are open to the public, and you're all welcome to attend, and we hope to see you there. The website of the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, very important to back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening, and stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.